Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, I'm Deputy Attorney General Andrew Kerber, appearing today on behalf of Delaware Transit. This appeal involves a union bus driver, Mr. Harry Bruckner, employed under a collective bargaining agreement between Delaware Transit and the Amalgamated Transit Union. Mr. Bruckner was discharged from his employment under the collective bargaining agreement following 8 failures to report to work in 12 months. The union grieved his discharge, and the matter was arbitrated under the collective bargaining agreement pursuant to American Arbitration Association.
Mr. Kerber, could you pull the microphone a little closer? I'm having trouble hearing you. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. The matter was arbitrated pursuant to American Arbitration Association labor arbitration rules. At the arbitration hearing, Mr. Bruckner and the union argued that Delaware Transit should have accommodated Mr. Bruckner's request to change his work schedule due to the fact that Mr. Bruckner's mother-in-law was sick and subsequently died from cancer. At the arbitration, the arbitrator ruled for Bruckner, although he acknowledged that the result was a deviation from the language of the contract. Following the arbitration, Delaware Transit learned that the arbitrator had lost his wife of 30 years to cancer only 3 months before the arbitration hearing. This caused Delaware Transit to lose confidence in the arbitration process and believe that the arbitrator may have been biased in favor of Bruckner. This case is before the Supreme Court today on the appeal of the Chancery, on appeal of a Chancery Court's grant of summary judgment to the union. Therefore, the standard for review for the court today is de novo.
Now, when you say may have been biased, so it's still a question of that there's no clear answer to? And you have, is it your contention that the integrity of the arbitration was in fact compromised?
Our argument is that under the arbitration rules, the arbitrator was required to make a disclose any circumstance likely to affect impartiality. Under the case law that has been developed in both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Delaware Chancery Court, we don't have to show actual bias. It is enough to show that we show that the failure to disclose
your case risks on appearance of partiality or bias. Is
yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. We basically the argument is that the appearance of partiality is generated by the life experience, that is the experience the arbitrator in losing his wife to cancer. Yeah.
Correct. Well, in other words, the facts of the case are that the arbitrator lost his wife of 30 years to cancer 3 months before this arbitration. And then at the arbitration hearing, the arbitrator learned that essentially the defense was Delaware Transit did not accommodate the employee to a needed change in schedule, that the change which was needed based on the death to cancer of the arbitrator's, or not the arbitrator, of the employee's mother-in-law. So essentially the entire argument was with respect to we believe there was a shared loss, and that made the arbitrator more sympathetic and therefore biased in favor of Bruckner.
So how would you articulate your rule so that it could be applied in future cases? And I'm not trying to make this difficult. The court would sincerely appreciate your help. If your spouse died 2 years earlier, is the fact that your spouse died of cancer the determining thing? Is it the fact that it's your spouse, suppose your niece or your nephew, and died of cancer? What is it that you want disclosed, and what would be the circumstances that would tell an arbitrator disclosure is required?
Well, I believe that all of these things, the factors you've indicated, Justice Holland would apply.
I'll tell you now, my mother died of cancer. Do you think that I should have recused myself from sitting on this case?
The standard for a judge is going to be different under Delaware state law. For a judge, the standard is first a subjective evaluation of whether the judge believes they can or cannot evaluate the case in an unbiased fashion, and then only if they can't believe they can't, they look at the objective standard of whether it would create a essentially a bad impression for the
Well, I mean, there's still an appearance problem or analysis that's that has to take place under a judicial disclosure qualification.
Yes, that would be
any different from the analysis that would take place in an arbitration setting as opposed to a judicial setting?
Well, on the one hand, it would be the same, but on the other hand, the Supreme Court's case in Commonwealth Coding says that that we should be even more scrupulous of arbitrators than we are of judges, since there is no appellate review of the arbitrator's evaluations of law and facts.
Well, as Justice Holland, I'm sorry, I was just saying, as Justice Holland asked, how do you translate that into a rule of law that could be applied in future cases?
Well, we believe, as cited by the Chancery Court in the Beebe opinion, they relied on a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that develops a rule. The rule reads as follows. If there is not, and this is the Richco v. Parkside decision, Wisconsin Supreme Court. If there is non-disclosure at the outset of arbitration, the test for vacator on the ground of evident partiality is whether the reasonable person, as a party to the arbitration proceeding, upon being advised of the undisclosed matter, would have such doubts regarding the prospective arbitrator's impartiality that he or she would investigate further, would demand that the arbitration be conducted on terms which would provide checks on the arbitrator's exercise of discretion, or would take other protective measures to assure an impartial arbitration and award. In the case of your mother's
death. My mother died 60 years ago.
And in that case, I would believe that that is sufficiently long ago that you are not likely to be biased. Had it happened 3 months ago, that might be another matter.
All right. And that's what we're talking about. How does a reasonable arbitrator know when to make a disclosure?
My mother died 30 years ago.
Well, again, 30 years and 60 years, I believe, are so
10
distant.
10 years.
10 years, I don't think we, again, farther than I would say. What I had argued or stated to the Chancery Court was perhaps a two-year standard, and that coming from a standard that had been applied by Chancellor Allen when he came on the Chancery Court bench as the amount of time that he would wait before he started seeing
cases. Why would it
be
limited to death from cancer? All of the circumstances can arise just from death by any cause, couldn't they?
They could, but I think given the fact that these really are such shared circumstances, that it's the same disease, the same loss in a short period of time, that's likely to...
Well, the loss of a parent is a shared circumstance and evokes sympathy and empathy. Why isn't that enough, no matter what the cause?
Well, in our case, we believe that it was a shared loss to the same disease. Which we believe would invoke sympathy and therefore a more favorable view or a desire to assist Mr. Bruckner.
So if it was a different disease, it would be okay?
Perhaps so. But I think we don't have that situation here. In this case, we have the same disease and the same result and in a very short period of time.
Right. Well, let's go back to the standard that you're arguing for. When we write this opinion, if you prevail, what's the objective rule that everyone's going to be able to understand and apply?
Well, I believe you would look at the rule that says that's American Arbitration Association Rule 17 that says that any prospective or designated neutral arbitrator shall immediately disclose any circumstance likely to affect impartiality. And in looking at the definition of impartial from Webster's Third International Dictionary, it states not favoring one more than another, treating all alike. In this case, it's been acknowledged that there would be feelings of sympathy with between the arbitrator and Mr. Parker. Similarly, the definition of sympathy in Webster's Third New International Dictionary in Part 3B states, tendency to favor or support the act, 4A, the act or capacity of entering into or sharing the feelings or interests of another, the character or fact of being sensitive to or affected by another's emotions, experience, especially sorrows. So we believe that the fact that they're based on the shared circumstances, there was sympathy, and that would therefore, under the definitions, create a circumstance likely to affect impartiality,
but
which were not disclosed.
Under your approach, if I understood your argument correctly, if the arbitrator's parent had died 3 years before the arbitration, or four or five, then there wouldn't be a disclosure required. Is that right?
I would say there has to be a period of time where it would be unreasonable to appear to
right. And
believe
by
that,
what,
that there's
by,
a grieving period.
By what criterion, either legal or factual, do we draw that timeline?
Well, it would be, again, the test that has been developed is a reasonable person test. So I'm not sure you can draw a hard and fast test, but I think it seems to be unreasonable to think that you would not be still impacted and sympathetic 3 months following the death of a spouse of 30 years to the same disease that you're now considering a case as the chief defense before.
Well, I understand your position that under any test, you know, if we accept your point of view, that this case would qualify. But we're still left with the problem of trying to give reasonable guidance to arbitrators in future cases.
Well, my view is that, you know, the arbitrators would, and the jurisprudence, I think, has said that they should tend to disclose more rather than less. So they should over-disclose rather than under-disclose. Should they disclose something that happened 60 years or 30 years or 10 years ago, that's really going to be up to the arbitrator. I would think that that's too long, that all those periods are too long, and that a period of 2 years, one year, 2 years is more.
Where do we get 2 years from?
Well, you get that.
Is it in a rule somewhere that we can cite? Is it in a statute?
I would rely on the reasonable person test. The reasonable person test is articulated by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in Richco, namely that you have to look at whether a reasonable person would have doubts about the.
I understand that,
yes,
but you have no way to make the leap from the words reasonable person to the number two, isn't that correct?
No, I don't.
Or the number three or four or whatever the number is.
I think it's going to, under each case, it would be, you would have to apply a reasonable person analysis, and the various factors that would be involved in the particular case would come into play.
Well, should it be a doubt or a serious doubt? I mean, is it just left open to speculation, or is there a higher bar to prevent every arbitration proceeding from being challenged later on the basis of some life experience?
Well, I think we have in this case a rule articulated which by the American Arbitration Association, which says circumstance likely to affect impartiality. So if it's likely to affect impartiality, that's enough. It doesn't say that it has to be likely to seriously affect impartiality. It says it's likely to affect impartiality. And, again, that's enough.
Well, how do you distinguish between disclosure and mandatory disqualification? Is it your position this should have been disclosed, or is it your position that this was a disqualification per se?
Our position is this should have been disclosed and was not disclosed. And in fact, in the rule that I'm citing from the American Arbitration Association, has a mandatory disclosure or disqualification sentence. It says no person shall serve as a neutral arbitrator in any arbitration under these rules in which that person has any financial or personal interest in the result of the arbitration. So that's the mandatory disqualification.
Right.
And then it goes on to a disclosure requirement. And we're not arguing that there was a
Well, the purpose of the disclosure would be to at least enable the one or both parties to the arbitration to decide whether or not to ask the arbitrator to recuse himself. Is that right?
That's correct.
I mean, so we're going to get into the issue of disqualification, or it's likely that we would in most of these disclosure cases. And so what is the arbitrator to do then? Is the arbitrator free to say, well, I've disclosed this, but I don't believe that's going to affect my impartiality?
In this case, had the arbitrator disclosed it, Delaware Transit could have requested a different arbitrator.
What was the financial or personal interest of the arbitrator, quote, in the result of the arbitration, unquote?
We're not saying that there was any financial interest in the result of the arbitration. And, in fact, if to read this, it says in it's
so
any...
You're really talking about a de facto disqualification, even though, it comes under the rubric of disclosure.
Well, Your Honor, it could well be that Delaware Transit or any arbitrating party would hear of this and say, that doesn't matter to me. I trust this arbitrator.
They might.
But they need to disclose it up front, and the failure to disclose it brings us to question the integrity of the proceeding.
Do you want to save your remaining time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. As Mr. Goldlust indicated, my name is Amy Rosenberger, and I represent the Amalgamated Transit Union, that is the collective bargaining representative for about 500 transit operators and maintenance employees across Delaware. This particular unit at issue here includes all of the paratransit operators across the state, of which Mr. Bruckner was one. I don't want to belabor the facts in the case, but I would want to initially focus on one factual distinction. I think the DTC has repeatedly in their briefs, as well as in the argument here today, stated that Mr. Bruckner was absent or actually in some cases late for work because his mother-in-law passed away from cancer. In fact, the event at issue here and the state has also indicated that was the central argument of the union. It was not, in fact, the central argument of the union that Mr. Bruckner was late or absent because his mother-in-law passed away. The argument was he was late or absent in the events at issue here that led to his termination because he didn't have reliable child care. It is true that his mother-in-law passed away from cancer, and the couple wound up having to find alternative child care that didn't wind up being reliable. But to say that he was terminated, the termination occurred because his mother-in-law had passed away, is at best a shading of the facts here. I also want to spend a moment.
So I suppose that you're telling us that because you're saying that the shared death of these two people with relatives that died of cancer or an in-law that died of cancer, it really wasn't relevant to deciding the case on the merits. And the merits really turned around whether he should be excused for being late because he was taking care of his children when he didn't have reliable child care.
Actually, that's not exactly what the union's argument was either. The union's argument was that in the past, when there were individuals who had a personal circumstance of whatever nature, might be their own medical condition, that caused them to not be able to report on time, where changing a run, or the bus run that the person is responsible for, changing the shift time essentially, would enable the person to report on time and carry out their duties as necessary, even in circumstances when that change wasn't permitted under the terms of the contract at that time. The employer and the union had worked out an agreement to make an exception to the contract.
So and you're saying that, and that could go on eight times, and that would be no problem?
There was only a request for it at the end. It would have been the one time. He was asking to change his – the specific scheduling problem with the babysitter was because his shift started at 6 in the morning and his wife worked the midnight shift, and there was an overlap in time. So to move him one time to a different shift when he wouldn't have to deal with the waiting for the babysitter would have accommodated that into the future.
So how did, well, help me understand whether the overriding concern should only be on the focus of this was the eighth time. You seem to be saying, all right, true, he had seven other problems. They're all irrelevant. What we're really talking about is this eighth time, which resulted in his termination, and we should have never gotten to the eighth time as being an unexcused tardiness because the union and the employer had reached an accommodation where this eighth time should have never been on his record. Is that right?
Well, if the employer had come to the union and said, will you agree to make this exception, there wouldn't have been an eighth time. And that's right. And the reason that it's important here is because the arbitrator's decision in the end, this would be a very different case if what the arbitrator did was to reach back before the termination and forgive the misses or the tardinesses or absences that occurred while the mother-in-law was ailing, was undergoing chemo, or at the time that she passed away. He didn't. He directed that Mr. Bruckner be returned to work at the point that he was prior to termination, which means he's got one chance left in this rolling 12-month period. He didn't reach back and do something that was outside of the scope of the grievance. The grievance was about the termination. He focused solely on the termination, and that's why it is important to look at that.
And what was his rationale, remind us for why the eighth time should have been excused?
Because in the past, the employer had worked with the union to, when an employee needed this sort of accommodation, there had been past occurrences where the employer would go to the union and see if we would agree to an exception to the contract. And the union testified they would have agreed to it in this case. What the employer did in this case is they didn't even go to the union and say, Mr. Bruckner has come to us and asked for this exception to the contract. Do you have an objection? Can we agree to it? The employer just said no.
But he did ask for the exception.
He did. In fact, I have to tell you, in 16 years of representing labor unions, I don't know that I've ever seen a situation like this. Mr. Bruckner, when he knew he was at his last chance, went to his supervisor to try to find other ways to deal with this so that his lateness or absenteeism wouldn't be a problem. One of the things he asked for was this change in shift. He went so far as to write a personal letter to the executive director of the agency. He was trying to avoid termination, trying to find a way that he could fulfill his responsibilities to the employer, and it was because the employer didn't do what it had done in the past for other employees, treated him differently, and didn't seek out the union to see if there was an exception. That was the arbitrator's rationale for reinstating him at this seventh step, you know, with one more chance upon reinstatement to maintain, you know, a prompt, punctual record. The other thing I wanted to mention just briefly, I don't want to belabor the point because we discussed this at length in our brief, but I do think it is important, and the panel did raise this at the beginning of Mr. Kerber's argument. The standard of review here, this court, as far as I'm aware, has not had occasion to express an opinion as to the standard of review for a labor arbitration award. I don't think there's any dispute that the standard is the tripartite standard that's been articulated on a number of occasions by the Chancery Court. Both parties to this proceeding have relied on the unreported decision in Mead, written by then Vice Chancellor Jacobs, now Justice Jacobs. And I think we agree that that lays out the rationale. I wanted to mention this simply because the standard that, at least in its opening brief, DTC said applies, that they're relying on here, is the prong that talks about that the integrity of the arbitration has been compromised. And yet in their reply brief, as well as some of Mr. Kerber's comments today, DTC seems to be indicating that although that's the prong they're relying on, they don't actually have to show that the integrity of the arbitration was compromised. And in reaching that conclusion, they rely on the arbitration cases regarding bias that they've cited, the Commonwealth Coatings case, the Bede Medical Center case, and the other cases that were referred to in their brief, all of which were commercial arbitrations, not labor arbitrations. And I mention this because it's important to note that the reason those courts did not talk about whether there was whether the integrity of the arbitration had been compromised is because that standard doesn't apply in commercial arbitration. Commercial arbitration is governed here in the state of Delaware by the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act. Certain commercial arbitrations are covered by the U.S. Arbitration Act, which
they still involve the concept of evident partiality.
That's
and would not evident partiality satisfy that the test, the integrity of the arbitration has been compromised?
It would if evident partiality were interpreted and applied in the way that it was interpreted and applied in those cases relied upon by DTC here. Those cases all involved a relationship between the supposedly neutral arbitrator, either a personal relationship with one of the parties or the lawyer for one of the parties, in some cases being represented in his own employment dispute by one of the lawyers for one of the parties, or having business dealings from which the supposedly neutral arbitrator gained financially with one of the parties. Those kinds of disclosures, certainly I can understand. And those kinds of disclosures as...
Well, in this case, what did the arbitrator know that would have even prompted a disclosure? Let's assume this is a hypothetical, that the arbitrator is told, you're about to hear a case of someone who was terminated because they missed work 8 times, and they missed work the 8th time because of child care problems that are attributable to the fact that their mother-in-law died of cancer, and the mother-in-law was the dependable babysitter, and subsequent to her death from cancer, they no longer had dependable child care. Was the arbitrator told anything like that?
No, and not until he showed up at the arbitration.
And then we're in the middle of the hearing.
Right.
And something like that might have been said, that we had great child care coverage until my mother-in-law got sick from cancer and died, and then we never had dependable child care. So in the middle of the arbitration, I guess the argument is the arbitrator said, well, and now that you've told me your mother-in-law died of cancer, I need to let you know my wife died of cancer 3 months ago.
That appears to be what DTC's contention is, because I can tell you that in labor arbitration, what the arbitrator knows, particularly when it goes through the American Arbitration Association, but in any other context that I've been involved in as well, what the arbitrator knows before he or she sets foot in that hearing room that morning is that there's a grievance, and usually it's not like a complaint in litigation or even like an arbitration demand in commercial litigation. What it would have said in this case, I'm not going to be quoting word for word, but typically in a termination case, it says, Harry Bruckner was terminated without just cause. Reinstate with full back and make him whole for all of his losses. That's what he would have known before the arbitrator set foot in that hearing room. And it wouldn't be until perhaps, I will tell you, I didn't handle the arbitration personally, so I can't tell you exactly what my partner said in her opening statement. It may well be that she said something in her opening statement. It may not have come up until Mr. Bruckner was testifying and about the circumstances that led to him having unreliable babysitting service available.
So you're saying that as a practical matter, whatever would prompt a disclosure on the part of the arbitrator wouldn't happen till at the very earliest, the moment the parties begin the arbitration proceeding.
That's right.
And perhaps in some cases later on during that proceeding.
That's right.
But certainly not before the proceeding.
Right, yeah. It would be a very unusual case if maybe someone not very experienced in writing a grievance had laid out chapter and verse. That happens very rarely in my experience.
From your perspective, would an arbitrator ever have to disclose a personal experience? And let's assume that the arbitrator does not have a financial or personal stake in the outcome of the arbitration itself, but has some personal experience, describe it as you will that ever have to be disclosed?
I think that there would be circumstances, and I actually look to, because the Commonwealth Codings plurality decision authored by Justice Black talked about, basically analogized arbitration to, or the rules that should be applied to arbitrators to the rules that are applicable to the judiciary. I looked at, for example, the ABA's model rules of judicial conduct, and I looked at the Delaware rules of judicial conduct, which are modeled on the ABA's rules. And the standards that are in those rules talk about, of course, the financial and or personal interest in the outcome of the case, but talk about relationships being the sorts of things that are disqualifying. Talk about actual bias that would be disqualifying. That is, but the examples that are given about bias are not common life experience. It's things like there is actually in the comment to the Delaware rules, there's a list of examples of conduct which evidences bias, and it's all things like epithets, slurs, racial or national origin stereotyping or gender stereotyping, you know, that sort of bias toward a party. It doesn't talk about...
Well, let's go back to this case where the arbitrator sees the names of the parties, and right, if one was a corporation and he or she had stock, they disqualify themselves or they knew someone. But let's suppose in this case all they see is that it's a corporation versus a union. And in my hypothetical, assume that the arbitrator's spouse is the member of a union. Are they disqualified, or is that something that should be disclosed, or it doesn't matter?
I would expect... I'm sorry, were you finished?
No, okay.
I would expect that if the arbitrator's spouse were a member of the union in
Not
question...
Not the union, a union.
A union?
Different union.
I believe the rules... There are also ethical rules that are published by the National Academy of Arbitrators, of which Arbitrator Simonette is a member. And those rules talk about... disclosures, if, for example, they don't talk about spouse being a member of a union as a required disclosure, but things like some arbitrators, not most, are sort of, their job is they do labor arbitration in the labor context as opposed to commercial arbitration. But some do, as they're sort of transitioning into arbitration, they still represent employers or unions or both. They are required to disclose that sort of personal connection to, even when it's not the parties that are at issue. And the rules, the National Academy rules actually talk about that disclosure, if it's not that, you know, the arbitrator represented ATU Local 842, but that the arbitrator still represents unions, they are not to identify all the unions they represent, but they are to say, I do represent unions. I suspect, although the disclosure about the spouse is not technically covered by that rule, that's probably one that falls on a line where maybe some arbitrators would disclose it. They probably would put it on their resume that gets distributed in the selection process or something along those lines.
Well, let's suppose a disclosure is made and someone says, I think you should recuse yourself, and you say no. What happens?
You being the arbitrator says no, or the other side says no?
The arbitrator says no, I'm not recusing myself.
If the, under the AAA rules, if it's a case governed by the AAA rules like this one was, then that dispute gets submitted to the arbitration association, and the arbitration association makes a decision as to whether or not the arbitrator should be disqualified. So there is a neutral body that has some review of that before you would get to a judicial situation. But I am sensitive to the questions that the panel raised when Mr. Kerber was arguing, because there is a question of where do we draw the line here, and there is a level of judgment that gets exercised by an arbitrator when it pops up in the middle of a hearing that there's a similar life experience.
So that there has to be either a relationship that is potentially compromising, that is bias creating.
Right.
Which didn't exist here,
right.
Or there has to be some actual categorical bias that is against an ethnic group or, you know, someone's sexual orientation, or you come up with whatever other category.
Or people in a certain line of work.
All right. And that's not involved here.
Right.
And is there any other, did I miss anything?
Well, no, this is relational. I mean, I actually had an arbitrator recently disclose upon his appointment.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. I was saying this is relationship-oriented, but I actually, on the spouse issue, I actually recently had an arbitrator disclose when he was appointed and was informed that I was one of the attorneys who had selected him. He disclosed, unbeknownst to me, that his wife is in a group of employees that are seeking to organize, and I'm working with the union that's seeking to organize them. But that's, again, a relationship issue.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing I'm used to seeing. And frankly, if there were a rule, DTC is asking this court to go where no one has gone before. If there were a rule along the lines of what DTC is asking, arbitrators who hear, and I'm going to give you examples of actual cases. Arbitrators who hear a case, for example, where a bus driver gets terminated for running too many red lights would have to disclose if they had tickets for running red lights. Arbitrators who hear a case involving an employee alleged to have engaged in theft would have to disclose if they or a family member had been mugged or burgled or, I mean, the kinds of things. These disclosures are not made. And just as, I mean, to the extent that the U.S. Supreme Court has sort of analogized the disclosure responsibility of arbitrators to that of the judiciary, imagine a judge who would have to, you've already raised this issue, but who would have to disqualify himself or herself because of a common life experience, even when the judge, in his or her good judgment, knows they can set that aside and be able to be impartial.
So you're saying, number one, that common life experience is not part of the existing set of criteria.
Correct.
Triggering disclosure, and moreover, it would be unworkable.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, some of what I was planning on mentioning, you all had already picked up on, which was, you know, what if it wasn't death from cancer? What if, I mean, we don't even know on this record whether it was the same kind of cancer, so technically it's potentially not the same disease. It is unworkable. It displays an amazing sense of distrust in arbitrators generally in their ability to know whether or not they're going to be affected by their life experience in a case. Obviously, if an arbitrator knows, you know what, this is too close to home, I can't hear this case, I believe, having dealt with arbitrators over my entire career, I believe that they have, and this arbitrator in particular, has the integrity to disclose if there is really something personal that they think they're going to have a problem with it, just as any judge would. And the idea that just the possibility that a party might think that this looks like it creates some impression of bias is unworkable, unfair, and frankly, we wouldn't have people who could be arbitrators. Everybody has life experiences.
I'd like to ask you to react to this type of definition to see if it's flexible enough and yet restrictive enough, whether a disinterested observer who is fully informed of the facts relevant to the arbitrator's conduct or alleged conflicts to develop a serious doubt regarding the fundamental fairness of the arbitral proceedings. Does that sound like a workable test or not?
It sounds like an I know it when I see it test, which is, you know, that's not to say that there aren't tests like that in the law, as we all know, but it sounds like there's wiggle room that would, and it, without a showing that there was actual compromise, that there actually was a result of this perceived potential bias, to me it sounds as though something, as if it's something that is going to lead to a lot more arbitration appeals, which is not what the public policy is behind the limited standard of review, and the desire, particularly in the public sector, to require arbitration of labor disputes rather than having them go to the courts. It's the kind of, I appreciate that it's a much stricter standard than what DTC has suggested would be appropriate here, but it is, it would be new ground, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
So, Mr. Kerber, do you agree that based on this record there would have been no way to know there should have been a disclosure prior to the proceedings, that it would have come up during the proceedings?
That's my understanding, Your Honor, is that at the hearing, the arbitrator would have learned that there was this shared event. And our contention is that that is as provided in AAA Labor Arbitration Rule 17, any prospective or designated neutral arbiter shall immediately disclose any circumstance likely to impact impartiality. So when he learned of it, he should have disclosed it at the hearing. And at that point, Delaware Trinity would have had the ability to decide whether to move forward with the hearing or if they wanted to address it by getting another arbitrator or impaneling a panel of arbitrators, something like that. But we did not learn of it at the hearing.
So in your position, now that we're focusing on this eighth miss, so to speak, is that even though he missed the eighth time after his mother-in-law had died because he no longer had predictable daycare, the fact that his mother-in-law had died and the arbitrator's wife had died gave him this common shared experience that would have compromised the arbitrator's ability to be impartial?
That's correct. We have argument from the union that the problem was with respect to child care, and that I suppose is correct, but I think you correctly articulated, Justice Holland, the problem with the child care was because the mother-in-law used to provide the child care, and regrettably now she was deceased from cancer. So it really is one and the same.
To speak in more conceptual terms, I gather that what you're saying is that even if once the arbitrator knew what the circumstances were of the eighth time, even if the arbitrator subjectively and sincerely believed that that would not affect his partiality, he should nonetheless have disclosed that life, that experience, that shared experience, because it might objectively affect a reasonable arbitrator's view of the matter?
I think, Your Honor, that it might have affected a reasonable person's
view. A reasonable view, outsider's view of the matter.
View with respect to the arbitrator's actual impartiality.
Okay.
And I can say in this case it did, in fact, impact Delaware Transit's view of the arbitrator's impartiality.
Do we know why Delaware Transit didn't want to accommodate his request when they apparently had accommodated other requests?
Your Honor, that's not a correct statement. I understand from my client that there's been one accommodation to a bus driver to change his schedule that was specifically agreed to with the union, that it was non-precedential, and that one accommodation was to allow that bus driver to attend alcohol counseling at a time when the only time that he could attend that counseling was when his bid shift had been. So they made a one-time non-precedential agreement to address that particular concern, but they have never made provision to accommodate any employee's child care needs. There's simply too large of an operation and too complex to address all of those needs.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and will take a brief recess.